Hi, I'm Chris Brennan, and you're listening to the Astrology Podcast. Today is Thursday, January 17th, 2013, and this is the fifth episode of the show. You can find the show at theastrologypodcast.com, and you can also subscribe to it via iTunes. My co-host today is Patrick Watson of the Political Astrology blog, and our main topic is a retrospective analysis of some of the things we learned from the 2012 presidential election in the United States. Because this is our first show since the one we did prior to the election in September, we plan to talk a bit about how our predictions for the outcome of the presidential election actually worked out in practice. Aside from that, we also discussed some techniques that did not work when predicting things about the election. That leads us to a discussion of the void of course moon and different definitions for the void of course moon, and the need for astrologers to perhaps rethink their position on how significant the modern definition of the void of course moon actually is in practice, especially in light of some of the events that have occurred in the past few months. Finally, the last thing that we discuss with respect to the election is the inauguration chart, since President Obama's second inauguration is coming up in just a few days, and there's a bit of an issue because there may be two separate inauguration charts. Later in the show, we discuss the end of the Mayan calendar and the age of Aquarius, since that's another event that took place since last September, and we discuss some of the pros and cons surrounding that phenomenon and exactly what happened and why things didn't work out and why perhaps we should be careful about associating the Mayan calendar with the age of Aquarius. This leads to a discussion of the 8-year Venus cycle and the usefulness of an actual astronomical and astrological cycle that the Mayans did use that still actually does have some validity, even if the sort of phenomena surrounding the Mayan calendar did not. And finally, this also leads to a discussion of the sometimes literal nature of astrological symbolism, how sometimes sometimes astrological symbolism is more abstract, but there are certain instances where it's just very literal, and why that is. So with that introduction out of the way, let's get started. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, let's get started with some news and announcements. So first things first, there are three big astrological conferences that are taking place this year in 2013. I believe that the first two actually both take place in May. The first is the Northwest Astrological Conference in Seattle, which always takes place at the same time each year at the end of May in Seattle. I'll be speaking at that conference on Hellenistic astrology. Then we have the American Federation of Astrologers are also doing a conference in May in Arizona. That was one that I attended a couple of years ago and spoke at. It was a pretty good conference. So that is also worth looking into. And then finally, the biggest conference of the year is the National Council of Geocosmic Research's conference in Philadelphia in mid-August. And that's going to be a conference where all of the organizations around the world, or all of the chapters that the NCGR has around the world, come together to form one big conference in Philadelphia. So it should be pretty spectacular. I'll be doing a lecture and then a workshop on zodiac releasing and timing peak periods in a person's love life at that conference. So if you're in the area, you should come check it out. I think they actually extended their early bird special until the end of January. So if you sign up right now, you can actually get it for pretty cheap. Whereas the closer and closer we get to the event, the more or the higher the price will be going. So that's the first piece of news. Let's see. Second piece of news is I recently launched a new course on electional astrology, and that's now available. It's broken up into a series of different lectures that are presented on my online course site. I've been working on it for a few years, and I'm pretty excited. So you can find more information about that course on my website at chrisbrennanastrologer.com. Other than that, the third piece of news is that I have a big announcement to make about a paper that I'm releasing with Benjamin Dykes about the origins of the assignment of the four elements to each of the signs of the zodiac and how that actually came about. Like, why why Aries is a fire sign and why Cancer is a water sign and so on and so forth, because that wasn't always the case. And there's been this kind of open question of how those assignments came to be at one point in the Hellenistic tradition about 2,000 years ago. And we actually recently figured it out. So the paper will be coming out soon. And then at that point, hopefully I'll be able to perhaps have Ben on again in order to do an actual show about it. And speaking of Ben, that brings me to the fourth piece of news, which is that Ben has already released another book since last fall. He released a book on astrological magic, and then he has another book on mundane astrology, which is the first of a, I believe, a trilogy of books on mundane astrology coming out sometime in the next few weeks. So he's already produced two more books since I interviewed him last fall. Which brings us to, in other news, our fifth point is that I believe scientists have confirmed that Ben is in fact a robot sent from the future in order to translate astrological texts. I think you were on the team of scientists that made that discovery. Patrick?
Yes, of course, of course. But that is true. He is he's amazing.
Right. He is a machine. Okay, so let's transition into some of our main topics. Our first topic, since it's been so long, it's been since September that we recorded the last episode, and at that point we talked about, we did an entire episode on the astrology of the presidential election. I thought it would be good to recap what happened, since it's now mid-January, and that's pretty much all wrapped up. So that was a big year for us, but it went pretty well. We had three really strong points that worked out in our favor, the three sort of key points that were somewhat unique about our prediction that ended up working out rather well.
Mm-hmm. I believe the first point was that, Chris, I believe that it was you, actually, that pointed out that the beginning of Romney's Virgo L3 period, starting on October 13th, would kind of begin a period in which he would not do so well, which was statistically validated by Nate Silver's projections. And by the polling data that we have, we see that it was in fact right on October 13th, the beginning of his new Virgo L3 period, that Romney's favorability ratings started to dip and Obama started to rise at that point after the second debate.
Right. Yeah.
So we correctly identified by using Zodiacal Releasing from the Lot of Spirit, we correctly identified that turning point.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that made our prediction unique, is not just that we predicted that Obama would win and that's what happened, but we predicted specifically that starting around October 13th, that both of them actually were in what looked like favorable periods and looked like peak periods with respect to their career in both of their natal charts coming out of the conventions over the summer and the fall. So they're both in reasonably good shape, but then leading up, and that both of them were in good shape leading up till mid-October. But then we predicted that starting October 13th, Romney would go into a different period that would last through till December. And at that point, things would begin to unravel for him, eventually culminating in the loss of the election. And then in retrospect, that turned out to be true. And we actually got some objective external validation from that in the New York Times pollster, Nate Silver, who had this great graph where he showed that Romney's numbers were rising, especially as a result of the first debate, all the way up until about October 12th. And then starting every day after that, they just plummeted all the way through until Election Day. So,
and then, of course, there was the big prediction. We did say that Obama would win, and he did. So that was the second, obviously, really big part of our prediction was, you know, who would win. So we definitely got that right. There was, there was a bit of a discussion that took place amongst the astrological community about projections about the Mercury retrograde that would happen on the day of the election. But Chris was able to find a lot of things about the election that did kind of fall under the category of what we would typically expect from Mercury retrograde, especially concerning Romney's Project Orca.
Yeah, I mean, most of the discussion in the astrological community, especially in the last few months leading up to the election was about the Mercury retrograde that would station retrograde on election day and what that would mean, and that because it was repetition of what happened kind of in 2000, that there might be similar delays for several weeks or other Mercury retrograde related issues. And we ourselves, in our original prediction, we recognized that as potentially being an issue, although we saw one of the things that we saw is it was specifically tied into Romney's chart, because a couple of the other timing techniques were also coinciding with the two time frames of Mercury stationing retrograde and Mercury stationing direct approximately 3 weeks later. So we knew that it was specifically tied into Romney's chart. It didn't necessarily seem to be tied into Obama's chart, though.
Yeah. Well, one thing that I've always noticed about Obama and Mercury retrograde periods, and I think this has a bit to do with his natal Mercury, is that Obama tends to have pretty good luck during Mercury retrograde periods. And I think that is because his Mercury was he was born with Mercury opposite Jupiter. And so I think his experiences with the phases of Mercury are kind of colored by Jupiter, which tends to be more fortunate. Whereas for Romney, you know, Romney was born with the Mercury retrograde conjunct Mars, which is especially problematic in his chart because he was born during the day. So his experiences with Mercury retrogrades, and even through the primaries, I noticed that he tended to get in more trouble during the Mercury retrograde. So, of course, the election itself happened with Mercury retrograde, and so Obama was able to benefit from it, and Romney did not.
Right. Which is a bit of an understatement, because Romney ended up – I mean, there was kind of a debate afterwards, because there were some astrologers that were kind of annoyed in the immediate aftermath of the election that things were wrapped up so quickly and that so many astrologers had said that there might be delays because of what happened in 2000. I think – there's a little bit too much.
Although there were some delays. I mean, Florida didn't. I mean, while Obama was projected to win in Florida, the official counting didn't actually finish until several days afterward. And
it's like
it's funny because while everyone's worst fears didn't materialize, even completely non-astrological commentators in the media and so forth were openly speculating about a repeat of 2000. So I think it's interesting that it was on everyone's mind whether you knew about Mercury or not.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I was saying is just that there were some astrologers that are a little bit too quick to jump on some of the other astrologers who had made predictions based on Mercury retrograde.
I agree.
When in fact, you know, this was definitely a unique election, mm-hmm. and there were definitely a number of problems with it, both sort of externally in terms of the circumstances surrounding the election for many people on election day, such as everybody on the East Coast that was hit by Hurricane Sandy a week before.
Right.
You know, this is will be, forever be remembered as the election where a hurricane came out of nowhere and slammed into the East Coast 1 week before election day.
Which was interesting because people also mentioned that weather had a role to play at both of the conventions as well. So there was an interesting... I thought that was a very kind of weird. I don't know what to make of it necessarily, but the Republican convention had to be postponed because of a hurricane, and they had to move Obama's final acceptance speech for his nomination inside because of a thunderstorm. And then the election itself is affected by another hurricane. It's just kind of interesting because we know that reading, but not just celestial omens, but weather omens are also taken into account in ancient traditions of astrology. So it's interesting to consider what role that might have for today.
Sure. Yeah, the broader study of omenology in when events take place and when they begin. So there are external events like Hurricane Sandy. There were major delays. There were certain races like in Florida and Arizona that were up in the air for weeks afterwards. It's just that it didn't matter this time. If things had come down to Florida, then we would have seen a repeat of 2000. And it's interesting that that was the one state which really did perfectly have a repeat of the circumstances surrounding 2000, in so much as it was so close that it took a couple weeks until the outcome was known. But even beyond that, there were problems inside Romney's campaign that was talked about quite a bit in the media in the aftermath, starting about a week after the election. Everybody was talking about this program, this Get Out the Vote program called Project Orca, that was supposed to be Romney's secret weapon in order to help him identify polling precincts that were underperforming and then calling all the supporters in the area in order to get out the vote at the last minute. And it was supposed to be this very high-tech program in order to help accomplish that. But it completely went haywire, and it was a huge Mercury retrograde-type fiasco on Election Day, which some people attributed to or said had a significantly negative impact on some of Romney's numbers on Election Day. And it's interesting because that's one of the ways that that was tied into his campaign, and one of the reasons that seems to have affected his campaign specifically rather than Obama's was because when Romney launched his campaign, not only does Romney have Mercury as the ruler of his ascendant and retrograde in his natal chart, but when he launched his campaign, he had Virgo rising with the sun and moon in Gemini. So he had a very Mercury-ruled inception chart for the start of his presidential campaign back in 2011.
That's right.
So it's kind of a lesson. I mean, you know, if for some people, like as you were saying with Obama, you've mentioned and demonstrated some events where he seems to do pretty well under Mercury retrogrades, whereas there's other people who, if you pay attention to the chronology, they do not. Or sometimes if you're trying to, you know, figure out how Mercury retrograde is going to affect something like this, you figure out which person is more dominated by that planet, and then you'll know which camp it's going to become more prominent in. But that wasn't the other thing. I mean, that wasn't the only thing. So in our original prediction, that was the problem. The problem was that we saw that Mercury retrograde was important and that it was stationing retrograde on Election Day, but we saw it as specifically being tied into Romney's chart. And it was tied into this other technique in such a way that it implied that there was something about the election, or there's something unfinished for Romney until about 3 weeks after the election. And we had a specific date range of, I think, 3 or 4 days at the very end of November of 2012, when whatever it was that was not finished for him would sort of come to completion. And that was part of our original prediction. If you go back, we basically said either this could indicate something like it happens globally in the sense of that there's a big delay in the election like 2000, or it could be something personal for Romney because it only seems to be tied into his personal chart. And the latter ended up being the case, because what happened is 3 weeks later, Obama fulfilled a promise he made on election night when he gave his acceptance speech, where he said he'd like to meet with Romney in order to see if they could work together or something to that effect. And 3 weeks later, Obama made good on the promise, and Romney went to the White House and met with Obama for a private lunch for a couple of hours, and they talked about some undisclosed matters. And we really have no idea what happened, but it was really striking that Romney just sort of emerged out of the White House after 3 weeks of
seclusion,
obscurity after losing the election, after such a huge event in his life. And then he went to the place that he really had been trying to get, like he'd been trying to, you know, move into the White House in some sense for the greater part of a decade. And and that was probably the point at which Romney got, at least to whatever extent he can, some sense of closure about what happened on November 6th. So that was the third major prong of our prediction, which actually turned out to be correct. So I just wanted to point that out. I mean, we did, I think, towards the end, especially once Hurricane Sandy showed up, like everyone else, we started assuming that it really was going to be like this big national ordeal, and potentially the election could be delayed. But which to some extent was true, but nonetheless, in our original prediction, we sort of left it open that these two different possibilities were taking place, and we weren't sure which it was going to be. So that's pretty good. I mean, on a scale of, I've come up with this new, we've got to come up with like a new measurement scale, I think, for astrologers of something.
How well the predictions are.
I like to call it, we called itness. Like what is the we called itness level of this prediction? And I mean, I don't know how you rank that, but we should probably work on that at some point in the future. But I'd say it was pretty high up there on the we called it in a scale in terms of not just predicting the outcome, but predicting two crucial things surrounding the election as far as important events that would take place.
I think, on a scale of lame to awesome, I think it was definitely close, like, to awesome.
Okay. So so that's that. Let's move on. So there are a few things that we learned from the election, just to sort of round this out and to give it some perspective. One of the things that we learned that I think the astrological community really needs to take note of is about the void of course moon. There was a lot, I don't say a lot, but there could have been more perhaps, but there was some ink spilled about the void of course moon at the time of Obama's accepting the nomination at the Democratic National Convention. A lot of that was surrounding or a result of that book, Secrets of a Stargazer's Notebook, where she quotes another astrologer who was the one who popularized the concept of the void of course moon, Al Morrison. And apparently the concept wasn't that widely used. I mean, it was a concept. I know that because it's in the Hellenistic text 2,000 years ago. It's in the medieval texts 1,000 years ago. So it's been a concept, but it wasn't this like concept. It wasn't necessarily used in the exact same way that it has been in the past 20 to 30 or 40 years. And it certainly wasn't something that people paid attention to every two or three days and wouldn't, you know, do anything at those times. And I think that this is one of the best examples where you can really perhaps, or we really should bring into question the modern conceptualization of the void of course moon and the modern definition of that concept.
So yeah, we just have too many examples now of the void of course moon resulting in successful endeavors. We have four major ones from Obama, beginning with his first presidential run announcement on February 10th, 2007. The moon was at 25 degrees of Scorpio, apparently void, but he won the presidency in 2008. He also announced his vice presidential selection, Joe Biden, I believe on August 26th, 2008, and the moon was at 29 degrees of Taurus, completely void by the modern definition, but Vice President Biden, well, Biden became Vice President Biden. And then what else do we have? Oh, yeah. The inauguration itself on January 20th at noon, of 2009, Obama was inaugurated, and people, I guess, depending on your perspective of Obama, you could say that the void moon manifested as a failure or not, but he was reelected. And then, of course, I think the really conclusive test is the fact that Obama was nominated to be the president, to be the Democratic presidential candidate a second time, under a void of course moon on September 6th of 2012, and he won the presidency. So we have four very solid examples of void of course moons, or apparently void of course moons, resulting in the exact opposite effect.
Outcome.
Yes.
There's a bunch of issues surrounding the void of course moon that people don't realize and don't take into account. And so there might be some ways of explaining this away. For example, first, there's at least, astrologers need to come to the realization, and we need to have a discussion about the fact that there's at least two, if not possibly three, entirely distinct or separate definitions of void of course moon. That the definition that everybody uses today is not the original definition, nor was it necessarily even the definition used more recently, a few hundred years ago. But through translations of ancient texts over the course of the past decade, we've actually learned that the original definition of void of course moon is that the moon does not make any applying, it does not complete any exact applying aspects within the next 30 degrees, regardless of sign boundaries. So that's a much different definition. That doesn't have anything to do with sign boundaries. It just has to do with the moon essentially not completing any exact aspects for the next 20 or next 48 hours, for the next two whole days, since the moon usually moves approximately 13 degrees in a 24-hour period,
It's a far rarer condition.
Yeah, it's a far rarer condition. This does not take place every 2 to 3 days. It happens much more infrequently than that, but it actually does happen every once in a while. But that's one of the reasons why it was seen as so special and so problematic, because and that's actually where the original term comes from, which was the original Greek term for void of course was kenodromia, which means running in the void or running in the emptiness. And it's because the moon, if it's moving for 30 degrees without running into any other planets, it's literally moving through a void in the zodiac, because there's a complete emptiness of any other planetary relationships that the moon is forming at that point for 2 entire days. And that is kind of striking, and that's also one of the reasons why it was viewed so negatively. But that then just brings up a separate issue, which is that some of the modern astrologers, like Al Morrison, would quote the ancient astrologers, like Firmicus Maternus, for their delineation of the void of course moon, which was always extremely bad and extremely negative, except apparently some of the modern astrologers, like Al Morrison, did not realize that Firmicus was using an entirely different definition of void of course than the one that they're using today. So that's a big deal, and that's the original definition, apparently. But then there's also the possibility of a third definition. In the early 1990s, Sue Ward wrote a paper where she argued that William Lilly's actual definition of void of course moon was not the modern one as it appeared, but instead she argued that William Lilly's actual practical definition of void of course moon is that the moon is not within orb of making any applying aspects to any planets within the next 12 or 13 degrees, or whatever orb you're using for the moon. So basically, void of course occurs somewhat more frequently, but it's basically any time the moon is out of orb from an applying aspect with another planet. So that's a potential third definition, and there's some historical debates over whether or not that's actually what Lilly intended in terms of what his definition of void of course was. But that, again, is another definition that doesn't have anything to do with sign boundaries. It just has to do with orbs and with applying aspects that the moon is or is not making. And that's really important, because ultimately I think the main thing we need to learn from this is that if the moon is applying to another planet, even if it's across a sign boundary, if it's a close application, you don't really have to worry about the fact that it's not going to complete the aspect before it changes into the next sign. And honestly, it's not that big of a deal, or at least it's not as big of a deal as some modern astrologers have made the contemporary definition of the void of course moon out to be. There may still be something to be said for that definition. There may be some interpretive value to it, and I very much think there is, but it's just not as extremely bad or extremely negative as the ancient definition, or as some people sometimes make it out to be, where you shouldn't do anything under a void of course moon, or anything that is started under a void of course moon will fail to come to fruition. Simply not true.
Yeah, it's much better that the moon just be late in the sign than directly applying to a malefic. I think the main importance about the moon is the applying aspects.
Yeah, and that was big.
And sign changes might indicate some sort of change in the circumstances. Like in Horary, we see that a bit, where if the moon changes signs, there's usually a change in the circumstances of whatever the moon is significating for, or acting as a significator for.
Right.
So there is an interpretive, importance, but not certainly not earth-shattering.
Right. And in point of fact, in Obama's in his acceptance chart for the nomination last fall, the moon was at the very end of the sign, but it was applying to a sextile or a square with Venus. So it was actually applying to a very positive aspect as soon as it changed signs within a few degrees. So it really was not a big deal. And if anything, it was indicating something very favorable in that chart.
And another thing to consider too is that in Obama's chart, he has his midheaven at 28 Scorpio and his IC at 28 Taurus. And with all of these examples that we found with the void of course, apparently void of course moon, the moon was at 25 or 28 or 29 degrees of Scorpio or Taurus. So it was making a major connection with very important points in his chart. So there's no reason to dismiss those or view this negatively just by themselves, because I think people were almost looking at them outside of, without any context of his natal chart.
Sure. And for all we know, that may have provided some mitigation, since that does seem to come up awfully frequently for him. Another thing that people need to take into account is that if you're using the medieval definition of void of course, or the, let's say, the contemporary definition, even in authors like Bonatti or in Lilly, they say that there are exceptions to the rule. And so they say that, for example, the moon is hindered when it's void of course, unless it's in Cancer or Taurus or Sagittarius or Pisces.
Which it was at the time of that he accepted the nomination in Taurus.
Right. And it was in Taurus. So there was a mitigation involved, so that even if you're using that definition, you still should have been more careful about, considering it to be the end of the world. But that kind of part of it, or those mitigating factors, have sort of been forgotten about. Although that's kind of problematic, because then if somebody wanted to defend the modern definition of void of course moon, that's probably the best way to do it, is you say, well, this wasn't a good example because, you know, there was that mitigating factor because it was exalted in Taurus. And I might buy that as an argument or as a counter argument, although then you're still going to have to contend with some of the other void of course moon examples in Obama's chronology, like the launch of his successful 2008 presidential campaign. And if you're able to somehow prove that was also not a good example, then I'll be impressed.
Go you.
Go you. Okay. So let's move on. So other things that we learned. So that was one of the big things I think that astrologers can take from the 2012 presidential election. Another thing that astrologers could take from it, or that we learned, is there's a big problem. I mean, there's two problems. Two of them are using inception charts. Let's start with the other one. Let's start with horary. Horary, as applied to, I mean, this is kind of a hobby horse of ours, which is that we really are not impressed by the application of horary astrology in order to attempt to predict things like presidential races. It seems like bad astrology, and I apologize to any of you that do that or that are offended by that. But I think there's something missing from the theory and the philosophy underlying that kind of violates some of the principle of horary astrology, which is the importance of that unique moment when you're casting the chart for the exchange of a question, and assuming that chart will give you the answer to whatever was inquired about. There has to be something special about that moment. And in the same way that there's something very special and unique about the birth of an individual. But if hundreds or thousands of other people are asking themselves that same question every day for like 2 or 3 years, your chart is not going to be terribly unique unless you are one of the candidates. If you are, you know, Barack Obama or Mitt Romney, and you ask, will I win the election? That's deeply personal, and that connects you and makes you one of the first house people. That gives you a right to be the first house. But if you were just asking who will win the election, you're one of 1,000 people that are asking the same question. And I really don't think that that's a compelling use of horary astrology.
And from people who I have, noticed using this technique, I mean, I know two people who would use this technique and came out to different answers. And so that just kind of invalidates the entire practice altogether, because there can only be one answer. And so it's not the answer that's right, it's the practice that's wrong. Asking yourself a question and asking yourself a question that you have nothing personally to do with. You can't ask Corey 2 + 2, right? And you can't ask, I don't know, this is a hobby horse, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, one of the main rules is you have to be personally involved in the question. And if you're not, then you don't have any business asking the question, and it doesn't tie you in and doesn't make you the first house. So, and I mean,
perhaps the chart might indicate that you're thinking about this particular topic, but yeah, it's not going to have any value. Really?
Yeah, I mean, and there's tons of different people came up with different answers based on that approach. And some of them said Romney would win, and some said Obama would win. It doesn't matter. Like, even if your chart, your horary chart, said that Obama would win, I don't find that impressive or compelling in the least, for the same exact reason. I don't find anyone who said that Obama or that Romney would win, I didn't find that compelling before the election either. You've got to use charts that are directly tied in with the election and with or with the people that are most involved and most crucial to the election itself.
And on that topic of which charts are relevant, you know, for determining an election, I think we really are down to just the people who are involved, because early voting has made using inception charts of election night or election day pretty useless. Who's to say now when the election really happens, when election day starts at different times in different states? Who knows when the first ballot is really cast? So I think we really are kind of down to just using the natal charts of the people directly involved.
Yeah, I mean, there's
other, using natal astrology.
I mean, there's other things you can still, there's perhaps other
ingresses. Things. Yeah, perhaps ingress charts.
Yeah, I mean, there's perhaps, ingresses. Yeah. There's the inauguration chart, which is an inception chart. There's, you know, the campaign launch charts themselves, which we had at least one of them and did actually tell us very important information about what would happen on election day. But it's just, you're right, that casting an inception chart and trying to find the start of election day itself is kind of a fool's errand at this point. And it's really not, like, none of the results of any of that were very compelling in terms of anybody who tried to cast an inception chart for the, you know, start of, let's say, election day itself. They're, what they ended up going with ended up being very subjective. And I think that's, unfortunately, in this era of early voting and everything else, that it's, we're going to have to retire that method until or unless somebody can find something that's a lot more compelling in terms of showing that this is definitely the beginning of election day or the beginning of when people start voting. Otherwise, I think that's a method, that's something we learned from this election, that we're going to have to move away from that method. So,
yeah.
So I think that's it for
the
election. That's what we learned from the election. And that was some of our successes when it came to this election. So, it was kind of a fun ride. I guess we're at the very end of the road at this point, because now we're just days away from Inauguration Day. And that has presented a bit of a problem since it falls, since January 20th, which is always Inauguration Day, falls on a Sunday. They decided to move the public inauguration to the following day, to January 21st, which is interesting since on January 20th at noon, which is always when the transfer of power occurs, it's when one presidential, according to the 20th Amendment since 1933, January 20th at noon is always officially when one president's term ends and the next one's begins. And the chart for that moment actually looks remarkably bad or remarkably inauspicious from an electional standpoint. Yeah. But it's notable that the next day at noon on the 21st, the chart actually looks remarkably much better, remarkably positive from an electional standpoint. And so there's going to be probably a bit of a debate in the astrological community in the near future about which is the correct chart, whether you should use the chart for noon on the 20th or if it's the public ceremony that really counts and it should be noon on the 21st. So what do you think, Patrick?
I think we kind of had this issue before last time,
right,
as well, because the Constitution also says that the president is not really the president until they really say the oath. So in that case, you know, it wasn't until the president said the proper words that he technically became the president, but then the other amendment says that it's at noon. So back in 2009, we decided that, you know, we kind of had to go with the more symbolically significant moment, which was, you know, noon on January 20th, because that was what is explicitly stated in the Constitution. It's also when he kind of did the public ceremony. In this case, it's kind of reversed, that the significant moment is the one that they are still honoring, the legal moment at which he begins his new term versus the public celebration. I think it is probably going to be the January 20th noon time that will be the official beginning of his term, and that does unfortunately come with some fairly ominous indications in the chart.
Yeah, what we've got is it's Taurus rising, because it's always Taurus rising on January 20th. So what changes? So the angles are always the same. What changes is the placement of the planets. And there's two problems with this chart. The first thing is that Mars is angular. It's in an angular house, and thus it's more prominent in this chart. And surprisingly, this doesn't happen very often. I went through inauguration days for the past 75 years or so, back until the 1930s, and there's only a handful of them that actually have Mars in an angular house. The two most recent were George Bush Jr.'s first term, starting in 2001. So that's the term that lasted from 2001 to 2005, which, as we all know, involved two wars, the Afghanistan War and the Iraq War. And then the one, the inauguration that occurred with Mars in an angular house prior to that was his father's, George Bush Sr., who was inaugurated in 1989, and that also had Mars in an angular house, and it coincided with, of course, during his term, the first Gulf War in Iraq. So that's kind of a weird precedent. There's a few others, like Harry Truman's second term, Harry S. Truman, his inauguration, which took place in 1949, that coincided with the Korean War during that term. Franklin D. Roosevelt, his second term in 1937, which technically America did not officially get involved in the war until 1941 in his third term. However, that was like World War II did break out in Europe during that term, and Roosevelt himself pushed very hard for rearmament and trying to get the U.S. in sort of a war stance in order to get it ready to enter into World War II. And he did everything short of basically officially declaring war against the Axis powers. So, yeah, so that's a problem. So we've got this problem because Mars, of course, is the planet of war. It's more prominent in these inauguration charts, and several of the ones in the past have coincided with major wars. There's also
the other problem.
Yeah,
the other problem is that moon. The moon is the next application of the moon is a square to Mars. Not only is it a square to Mars, but it's also very close to the nodes. So Mars itself is square to the nodes, while the moon is approaching a node, which generally, you know, you don't, the old rule from Valens about inceptions is you never want the moon to be in the quadruplicities of the nodes. So even though the moon is in Taurus, it's, you know, right by the nodes, and it's square Mars, and so it doesn't look good.
Yeah, and the moon applying within a degree to a square with Mars in the superior position up in the 10th house, and the moon in the inferior position in the 1st house, in a day chart where Mars is more malefic due to the concept of sect, that's basically one of the worst possible conditions that you could have in an electional chart for the moon. And in an article I published on the Political Astrology blog recently, I talked about some of the implications of that and some of the other instances in which that's occurred, and they're not very good for the sake of the president. So we'll kind of leave it at that. But it's interesting that on the following day, 24 hours later, the moon has left that. It's completed that square with Mars, and it's even moved out of Taurus, and instead it's ingressed into early Gemini, where it's applying to a conjunction with Jupiter in a day chart and a trine with Mercury.
So it's also a lunar return for him as well.
Oh, yeah. So his moon's at, what, 2 or 3 degrees Gemini?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's really striking because it goes from being one of the worst possible electional alignments, which is moon square Mars in a day chart applying within a degree, to one of the best possible electional alignments, which is the moon applying to a conjunction with Jupiter in a day chart within a few degrees. So I don't know what that means. Like, we've been hoping for a while that what that means that there's a reason why this terrible electional chart on the 20th happened to fall on a Sunday, which forced them to move the public inauguration to the next day. And that perhaps in some way that public inauguration and the fact that everything, all of that will take place in front of the country on the 21st under the more auspicious chart, that there's something significant about that, and that somehow perhaps that will be the more important symbolically significant inception for his second presidency.
Yeah, but it may not matter.
Yeah, but then if you look at the Constitution, it's pretty clear in Amendment 20 that one president's term ends on noon on the 20th, and the next president's term begins that time. And the Obama administration itself appears to agree with this, because they're going to go ahead and do a private oath ceremony on the 20th anyways, presumably around noon, because they also appear to know or think at least that his term will begin that day. And maybe they're just covering all of their bases like they were with the last inauguration, but...
Yeah, one explanation for the moon conjoining Jupiter is too... I mean, the moon-Jupiter conjunction is a good thing maybe just for the ceremony. The public ceremony will go well, you know, with the moon conjoining Jupiter, but with moon squaring Mars on the day that he actually is supposed to start his new term is more of a symbol for his entire term. But either way, before you get too bummed out, if you're listening, you know, there actually is a very unexpectedly good thing about either inauguration chart, which is that Mercury, the planet of commerce and markets, is in a very tight trine, applying to a trine to Jupiter in Gemini. And it's going from, I believe, the 10th house to the second house. And that is also about finances and money. So it does look like, to some extent, that we may see an improvement in the nation's finances due to the restorative nature of Jupiter. And Jupiter is in Gemini, which is Mercury's domicile. So there are some that's somewhat unexpected, because you know, who would guess that you know, the economy might improve before? But I mean, that does really seem to be.
That's especially if the second chart is the most important chart,
right?
But if it isn't, then I guess there's still some good indications, but it's not emphasized, or the positive economy indications are not emphasized as much. Okay, well, I'm kind of bummed out now, so let's move on to the next topic and just get away from the 2012 election and get away from politics. So what else happened? I guess we have some other topics on the one thing that happened immediately after the election. It's kind of funny, because a week or two after the election, there was nothing. You know, it's just over very suddenly, and nobody had anything to talk about. And then all of a sudden, this sex scandal with Petraeus broke out, and a lot of the astrologers were commenting. I saw a tweet by Jeff Jarre, who just remarked about how perfect like a sex scandal involving the two major intelligence agencies in the United States, the CIA and the FBI, how perfect the symbolism was, because there's an eclipse in Scorpio right around the same time that took place in mid-November. And then that just brought me to, because it wasn't just that. And my own personal observation was interesting, that because it wasn't just that it was a sex scandal and it was involving, you know, these intelligence agencies or these spy agencies. But also one of the things that was funny is around the time of the eclipse, some of the news stories and the op-ed pieces started turning towards topics having to do with like personal privacy and personal secrets and things like that, because in reading the stories, a lot of people realized that how they were busted was that the FBI basically just got access to their email accounts and started reading everything and then was able to figure everything out. And one of the side effects that happened as a result of that, or one of the spin-off stories, was just people started writing op-ed pieces about or pieces about how to protect your privacy online, and suddenly personal privacy and like personal secrets became like a topic of the day in some of the news venues for about a week right around the time of this major eclipse. So I just thought that was funny, and it just raises this issue where sometimes astrological symbolism can be very literal. And that's not all the time, but sometimes it really is. And it's always striking when that happens, because sometimes you're not expecting it. Sometimes you're expecting it to be much more abstract, but in some instances it's just
very literal.
Yeah, it's just like beating you over the head with it just over and over and over again.
I mean, it was even a general, you know, and Scorpio's, you know, Lord is Mars.
Right.
Or, you know, Scorpio is the home of Mars, the warrior.
All of it. And then the FBI. And I mean, some of this wasn't probably just, I mean, I should say, unless you assume that I'm thinking of this too simplistically, it's not just because it occurred in the sign Scorpio, but it's also tied into a bunch of inception charts that also happened to have Scorpio very closely tied into them. I mean, I know, for example, that the chart for the FBI has a lot of heavy Scorpio placements, and I think it has like Saturn.
Naturally.
Right, naturally. But that's part of the reason why. It's not just because there was an eclipse in the Scorpio, but it's also because it was taking place, that eclipse was in a prominent house and a prominent sign in many of the inception charts for the organizations and the people who were closely tied into the event.
That's cool.
Yeah, I mean, and that in and of itself gives you some insight into the nature of astrology that, you know, they have these placements in these signs. Like, I think the FBI itself has Saturn in Scorpio because, if I recall correctly, J. Edgar Hoover founded it during his Saturn return, and he himself had Saturn in Scorpio.
Makes sense.
I need to check into that and make sure that's correct, but I'm pretty sure that was the case. And then, of course, we have Saturn ingressing back into Scorpio in October, and then this entire thing coming out of nowhere. But sometimes the placements and the symbolism or the basic symbolism in a person's chart or even in an organization's chart can sort of lie dormant there until something activates it. And then at that time, you will see the symbolism come out in a very literal way. One of the problems I've been dealing with recently, though, a big problem that I'm trying to wrestle with, is that sometimes the manifestation of the astrological event, it doesn't always take place within the visual sort of the person who it's happening to doesn't always see it, but that doesn't mean that something important didn't happen in their life. This is coming up more and more frequently for me and starting to bother me a little bit.
You don't know everything that happens to you. You can't, there are some things you just can't know, but do happen.
Right.
That do concern you.
Right. Like sometimes you're, you know, applying to a job, you know, when was that decision actually made that you were going to get the job? Was it when you heard about it at that moment, or did it happen like days earlier when you had that important aspect that went exact, but then no event took place in your immediate sort of frame of reference?
But that might have been when the decision was made.
Right. That's basically what I'm seeing. And there's a lot of that going on, and it kind of bothers me because then, I mean, it's interesting because one of the implications is that on some level, either all or most or more than we realize, more of the configurations and the exact transits and the exact aspects or things of that nature, the activations with Time Lords or progressions, are probably actually resulting in events or resulting in the initiation of circumstances that eventually culminate in something important. But it's not always, it's just that it's not stuff that we see in our field of vision, and therefore, but that doesn't necessarily make it unimportant. So it's very important. Anyway, so that's a topic I'm looking into, and hopefully I'll be able to go into with more depth with some actual examples. I have some examples, but I'll go into it some other time. Other topics that we wanted to bring up. What are you interested in talking about at this point?
Well, we talked a little bit about the end of the world earlier, and gladly that didn't happen this year. last year rather, as people predicted would happen on December 21st, 2012. We are still here. And it was a completely non-astrologically based prediction, but nonetheless, some astrologers thought it would be good to kind of hitch the wagon of astrology to this millenarialist fad.
Yeah, I mean, this was the latest in a long line of millenarianism and of people trying to predict either the end of the world or when important world-changing events would take place, either of a literal physical nature or of some sort of spiritual nature, that there will be a worldwide spiritual transformation or what have you. And I mean, there might be some people that are still trying to argue that that's what happened. I think they're mistaken, though. And I think that the astrological basis of 2012 was very shaky. And it was oftentimes, it's like people, it was based originally on the Mayan calendar, but most of the people that were using it, they were taking other astrological ideas like the age of Aquarius or precession or things like that, and they were applying it to the Mayan calendar, which was not originally what the end of the Mayan calendar was based on. The Mayan calendar is based on other things like Venus cycles, like the 8-year cycle of Venus and other interesting things like that. And it was not based, I mean, I guess one of the arguments is that it was based on precession, but then if that's true and it was about the galactic alignment or the alignment of the galactic center with the winter solstice, then that was actually much closer about 10 years ago, closer to 1999 than it was to 2012. So,
yeah. Something I thought was kind of interesting about the prediction for December 21st, 2012 is that it technically was a Jupiter return of the end of the year 2000, which was when we had kind of another big fear about the world ending. Y2K.
Sure.
So it's interesting that Jupiter kind of brought back this this topic back into people's consciousness.
Yeah, and it also brought into, I mean, a lot of astrologers or a lot of New Age people were talking about the age of Aquarius, and that was another topic that sort of came up, although that's, you know, that's been around for over a century now. People have been predicting when the age of Aquarius is going to start, and...
Yeah, the problem is that the constellations aren't like perfectly evenly spaced or symmetrical. Or I mean, there's at least a few hundred years before like you really know you're in one constellation versus another. A part of Aquarius overlaps into Pisces. Maybe we're in the age of Aquaces right now, or Pyquarius, but Pyquarius. I don't know. Pyquarius, I like that, yeah.
That sounds delicious.
Got some fried Pyquarius later. Right.
Yeah, the age of Aquarius, though, there's a lot of problems with it. And I mean, I saw somebody posting like a week afterwards in late December, after December 21st, it was this hilarious graphic that said that the age of Aquarius had begun on December 21st, 2012. And I really have to just be clear that that's probably not the case. There's not really any good reason to associate December 21st, 2012 with the start of the age of Aquarius for the reason that Patrick mentioned, which is that the constellations of Pisces and Aquarius overlap. So there's going to be this long period where you're kind of in both for a while.
Although,
right, but we haven't even reached that stage yet, because the vernal equinox has not even crossed the first star in the constellation of Pisces, as far as I'm aware, based on most ionomshas. So even if you go with, I mean, there's two things. If you go with the fact that they're overlapping, then we've got probably like 100 to 200 year span of time where you're going to be in both, and there's not going to be a clear transition where everybody becomes enlightened all of a sudden. Two, the beginning of Pisces, as far as a constellation goes, we haven't hit it yet. So we're still a ways away. I think some of the ranges put it closer to like 2060.
Wow. I think we should definitely make t-shirts then saying, "Welcome to the age of Pyquarius."
Pyquarius. That can be the official mascot of the show.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
There we go. $60 each.
So, and even the age of Aquarius itself, whatever you think that it is, you probably have a somewhat mistaken view of that, because there's a lot of, in the past 100 years, there was a lot of hopes and wishes about this future, especially based on the Theosophists, because the Theosophists in the early 20th century were really the ones that initially promoted this idea of the age of Aquarius. And they thought that humanity was evolving spiritually, and that we were getting ready to go into a new spiritual age where everyone would be enlightened and everything would be better, and so on and so forth. And so they grasped on this idea of the Age of Aquarius, and they started attributing it a lot of very positive qualities. And they started making it so that the sign Aquarius and the qualities associated with it slowly kind of changed to be much more positive and much more close to their ideal of what they wanted the coming 2,000-year period to be all about. But the problem with that is that wasn't really – so we have a problem.
It's quite Piscean, actually.
Right, that's true. And we have a problem now, which is that some of the interpretations of Aquarius are oftentimes, especially within the context of discussing the astrological ages, have more to do with people's – with this earlier inherited – predisposition to want to view the Age of Aquarius as being this great thing, and they ascribe all these positive qualities to it quite aside from what it actually means in astrology, or what that sign actually meant traditionally or anything else. I mean, worst case scenario, but traditionally speaking, the Age of Aquarius was an air sign that was ruled by Saturn. So worst case scenario, we're going from traditionally a period ruled by Jupiter and a water sign to an air sign that's ruled by Saturn. So, welcome to a 2,000-year period of Saturn. That doesn't sound quite as exciting.
No.
You can't really write as many books about that. It's like not as snappy. so that's, that's kind of like worst case scenario from a traditional perspective. Best case scenario, not even best case, but from a modern perspective, if you want to argue for traditional rulerships, what you've got is Uranus. And sure, we've got things having to do with like freedom and liberty and everything else. But then also you've just got things like technology and sort of greater focus on technological things and on the air qualities associated with an air sign. So you have greater increase of communication and things like that, let's say, that this is a great technological age. But even in the past 10 years, I mean, while we've seen many of the benefits of technology in, let's say, connecting more people around the world, we've also seen a lot of downsides. I mean, there's downsides to technology. Technology itself is not necessarily always inherently good, but there's got to be some drawbacks at the same time.
Progress has a dark side.
Sure.
And actually, talking about, just as you mentioned, connecting the world, another thing that we wanted to talk about for a bit was the transit of Venus, which happened in 2012. That's a fairly rare event. We won't see another one for, I forget how many years, however many hundred years. But what we thought was interesting, comparing the 2004 transit of Venus in Gemini to the next one years later in June of 2012, was that back in 2004, a little site that was beginning to get more popular called Facebook was officially incorporated. And over those 8 years since that time, Facebook grew and grew and grew. And as Venus does, it connects people together, connected the world together. And by the time that Venus went retrograde again in Gemini, 8 years later, Facebook officially applied to, become, to give an initial public offering of its shares. It said to become go public. And I think that sort of represents a culmination of its efforts to connect the world and doing what it did over the course of those 8 years. And it's interesting because people are commenting basically that Facebook is kind of reaching maximum capacity, that it's kind of got as many people connected as it can. And now they're trying to find other ways of keeping the site relevant, but they can't really grow much more than they already have. But I just thought it was interesting that it was bookended basically by those two transits of Venus, which connected the world together on a virtual platform.
Yeah. And that's something that the Mayan calendar was partially based on, that 8-year transit of Venus, where every 8 years on the same day of the year, let's say April 1st, 2012, Venus would have been in the same position in the sky approximately, or the same position in the zodiac, as it was on April 1st, 2004. So every 8 years, there's this exact repetition where the Sun and Venus are both approximately in the same part of the zodiac and have approximately the same distance between the two of them, or the same phase relationship. And that's an actual astrological technique that you can use very well in order to time events, that sometimes, especially during Venus retrogrades, since Venus retrograde goes in this, when it goes retrograde, it'll go retrograde in the same spot in the zodiac approximately every 8 years. You can use that in order to time things, or to say that there's going to be an important repetition of events or important connection between what would usually seem as separate events. So, for example, this year, John Kerry became much more prominent all of a sudden, and this happened in a few different ways. One, he gave a pretty decent and pretty successful speech at the Democratic National Convention in September. And that was interesting because 8 years prior to that would have been the summer of 2004, and that's when he would have been the nominee at his own convention. So what we have there is an exact eight-year repetition of the Venus cycle, where back in 2004, he's the candidate for the presidency, and then 8 years later, all of a sudden, he's important again on the political stage, and he's involved again in the Democratic National Convention.
Well, it's also important to note that even at that point, people were floating his name as a possible replacement, as probably the more likely replacement for Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State. And now Obama has officially nominated John Kerry to fill that position. So, yeah, in a similar way that his profile rose in 2004 as a presidential candidate, his profile rose again in a very similar way to, you know, become Secretary of State.
Sure.
Although this time it definitely turned out better for him.
Yeah, and even before that, in the lead up to the debates, he was Obama's primary debate partner, and he stood in for Mitt Romney as the he pretended to be Mitt Romney and then debated against Obama. And if you just think about that, 8 years prior to that, he would have been doing the same thing, but he would have been on the other side. He would have been Obama, and he would have been debating against somebody who was pretending to be George Bush.
And That's the other very weird connection between John Kerry and Obama, which is that it was also at the 2004 convention that John Kerry gave Obama a shot at having the keynote speech, and that was that speech really kind of began his career. That was when people first started talking about Obama as a candidate. So John Kerry in a lot of ways helped Obama kind of get where he is, and now Obama's helping him get where he wants to go.
Right. And then this all culminates in being selected as Secretary of State, and that's huge. I mean, 8 years ago, during that same time in December, Kerry went from probably one of the lowest points, I would assume, in his career or his life, in terms of having just lost the 2004 election after having been so close, to 8 years later, suddenly he gets what will presumably be the highest political appointment of his life. So that's a way that you can sometimes use. Sometimes there's some people, and there's some people whose chronologies and lives are very closely tied into the eight-year cycle of Venus, and you'll see these very important events playing out according to that eight-year cycle. And you just have to Sometimes you just have to look through the chronology and identify it. But once you've identified it, you know that they're tied into certain Venus cycles. So that's one technique that we wanted to mention, since that's a much more practical, I think, takeaway that we could get from the whole Mayan calendar craze, is that one thing that the Mayans actually did do, if you wipe away all of the things that they didn't do with respect to the Age of Aquarius or 2012 or what have you, one thing that they did do is they did pay attention to the transits of Venus, and that's still a viable astrological technique today. So with that, I mean, I think that's pretty much it in terms of the topics that we wanted to discuss today. There's a few other things we could discuss, but I think we'll save those for another show. Is there anything else you had that you wanted to catch us up on since our last show, Patrick?
Nothing that I can think of, but I'm sure we'll have another time to talk about all the things we talk about.
Okay, well then I think that pretty much brings us to the end of our show. So I guess I want to thank our listeners for listening. I want to thank Patrick for being my co-host again, and hopefully we'll have him on again in the future.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Well, that's Chris and Patrick for the Astrology Podcast signing off. Thank you.